Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
It's Wednesday, the 24th of August. A very good morning to you and welcome to this edition of Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, guarded praise for Nigeria's counter-terrorism efforts from US Secretary of State John Kerry.
Your country has taken back most of the territory that the terrorists have once captured. We have to ensure that military action is coupled with a reinforced commitment to the values like respect for human rights.
Also on the programme, a former ANC freedom fighter in South Africa tells DW the ruling African National Congress has abandoned its main principles, disappointing many who had high hopes in the party 20 years ago.
I think the African National Congress has digressed and departed from its founding principles. It has marginalized intellectuals within the ANC and basically sacrificed a large part of the founding principles of the liberation movement.
Stay tuned to this edition of Africa Link.
Top story.
US Secretary of State John Kerry has praised Nigeria for reclaiming swathes of territory from Boko Haram and releasing thousands of hostages over the past year. But he warned that Nigeria's battle against Islamists will only succeed if the government and its military gain the people's trust by not using excessive force to fight extremists. He was speaking in Nigeria's northern city of Sokoto after meeting religious leaders, who included the Sultan of Sokoto, Muhammadu Saad Abubakar III. From northern Nigeria, Muhammad Al-Amin sent us this report.
Security, good governance and respect of human rights are the key issues that the US Secretary of State John Kerry talked about while in Sokoto in northern Nigeria. Speaking at a press conference in Sokoto, Kerry praised Nigeria for reclaiming swathes of territory from Boko Haram and releasing thousands of hostages over the past year.
Your country has taken back most of the territory that the terrorists have once captured. And Cameroon, Niger, and Chad, and Benin have made important contributions and enormous sacrifices in areas along Nigeria's borders. But we also know that beating Boko Haram on the battlefield is only the beginning of what we need to do.
On Tuesday morning, the Nigerian military claimed to have killed several Boko Haram commanders and fatally wounded Abubakar Shekau. But in the wake of this development, Kerry cautioned against heavy-handed responses and emphasizes respect for human rights whenever dealing with security matters.
To effectively counter violent extremism, we have to ensure that military action is coupled with a reinforced commitment to the values this region and all of Nigeria has a long legacy of supporting. Values like integrity, good governance, education, compassion, security, and respect for human rights.
After all the strong statements that John Kerry made while in Sokoto, northern Nigerians expressed mixed reactions. While some saw his visit as a welcome development, others seemed not to be swayed by his message of resilience.
Majority of us believe that America has advanced in issue of security and even economically. And I believe his coming to Nigeria is a sign that America is ready to help us. And I think if we can get that, at least the federal government will be able to achieve its goal in the fight against terrorism and even corruption.
I think this is a good development for our country. What Nigeria have actually lost during the last regime is exactly what it's gaining back this time around. So it is a positive impact that is going to be made on our country. If Nigeria can do it on its own, it will have done that. Why they are inviting America is because they can't do it alone.
It's not welcome because the United States have made a lot of this kind of interventions in different countries, but it has not yielded any benefit to those nations. So America consider itself first before anything. So I don't think if this one can make difference from the usual interventions the United States of America is doing.
A sample of public opinion in northern Nigeria, ending that report by Muhammad Al-Amin. Later, the US Secretary of State held talks with Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari in Abuja. An unnamed senior US official said Kerry had made very strong commitments to Nigeria on ways to ramp up military assistance to help the country defeat Boko Haram. The US is currently considering the sale of attack aircraft to Nigeria, which is subject to review by Congress. The US official also said a large part of the one-hour meeting between Kerry and Buhari was dedicated to Nigeria's economic problems and how growth can be boosted. Kerry offered to supply additional assistance on the economy. But what are Nigerians themselves making of this visit by the US Secretary of State? Eunice Wanjuru put that question to DW's Ben Chemang in Abuja.
Many Nigerians incidentally have very high hopes when it comes to fighting insurgency and Americans having a hand in it. In fact, it became the topic of the day, whether on radio, TV, newspapers, analysts here and there. They still believe that there was this great hope. And of course, the place was bubbling, even in the State House.
And what can you tell us about Kerry's meeting with President Muhammadu Buhari?
They actually met in closed doors. Of course, they did not also do what they call the usual press conference thereafter. But feelers from it have it that they discuss security, especially when it comes to Boko Haram matters. Outside that, they also talk about what they call extremism in religion. How do you remove extremism? Again, there's the need to revamp the Nigerian economy while also fighting corruption. These are a whole lot of things that they discussed.
We also understand that John Kerry met separately with some of the governors. Why is this? Could the agenda have been different?
These are five governors that Kerry met with after meeting President Buhari. They are from the northern part of the country, particularly those worst hit by Boko Haram, talking of Borno, Bauchi, and Adamawa. Outside that, you also have Sokoto and then Kwara State. The idea, according to some of these governors that when we spoke after, they said the northern part of the Nigeria has most of the problems. Is it illiteracy is mostly affected by the north? If you are talking of out-of-school syndrome, it's mostly that of the north. Here again, you have Boko Haram attacking many parts of the north. So the whole thing is they selected some of these governors so that it's going to look like trying to salvage a very bad situation. And therefore, they spoke about agriculture, health, education, and what to do in terms of de-radicalizing those who indeed have decided to imbibe the spirit of Boko Haram.
But then he met separately with them. Can you tell us about the relationship between the president and these governors?
Well, the issue is they all belong to the same political party, the All Progressive Congress. But when it comes to key national issues that affect the whole country, of course, that was when he decided to meet with the president. But when you are talking of poverty and how some individual state governors can handle some of these problems within their states, because this is a federation where the federal government is different from state governments. The state governments are there with their agenda, what to do that will have direct impact on the people who elected them. So they spoke about health issues. What would they do in terms of health? And again, you're talking of education. Because the North is backward, some of these states are also really backward. And with the advent of Boko Haram, the school will have worse hit in terms of even education. Teachers, pupils are killed, you know, people running away from school. Bearing in mind that the name Boko Haram actually means Western education is prohibited.
Now to go back to the first question, can you say that business was as usual in Abuja?
Well, business was as usual, bearing in mind that this was not a president who was coming and therefore some streets would have to be blocked here and there. Business definitely was as usual. But when it comes to intellectual discussions, you could find them in newspapers, you could find them in radio stations, you find TV stations and people discussing this visit and what it means to Nigeria and of course, what it means to the two countries. So for the usual hustling and bustling in Abuja, yes, it was there as usual. Incidentally, there was supposed to be this protest by Bring Back Our Girls. Of course, they were blocked by the police, so they couldn't do anything.
Ban Shemang in Abuja.
News, analysis, and feature reports. All that here on Africa Link.
This month, South Africa's ruling African National Congress sustained heavy losses at local elections. For the first time since the end of apartheid, the ANC lost control of Johannesburg, the country's economic hub, and a new mayor from the main opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, was installed. Ashley Ali is a South African entrepreneur and a former ANC freedom fighter who lived in exile in the 1980s. I asked him why the ANC was losing support in South Africa.
I think the African National Congress has digressed and departed from its founding principles. It has marginalized intellectuals within the ANC and basically sacrificed a large part of the founding principles of the liberation movement.
Is this a process of decline which can be reversed?
I doubt that it could be reversed unless there is a very radical transformation within the party. However, it appears as if the core of the party has basically been captured by elements who are not prepared to change. So my prognosis is that the party is in serious decline and that it would probably lose power within the next few years.
To what extent is Jacob Zuma to blame for the current state of the ANC?
I think Jacob Zuma has a lot of blame to carry for the decline of the party. But the rot has spread so far and deep that you cannot blame Zuma alone anymore. The ANC is to blame.
Looking back 20 years, presumably you have the feeling that the South African economy could be in a far better state than it is at the moment had certain things been decided differently. Where do you think things started to go wrong?
I think that the economy began faltering with the change of presidents in 2007 when President Mbeki was removed and a more populist policy environment was created. You had a situation where a lot of depth in terms of skills were lost to the African National Congress, and you saw a gradual degeneration of the policy environment.
How do you see the future for the South African economy post-2019, which is when the next elections are going to be held?
I think the economy is going to face headwinds over the next few years. But I think post-2019, 2020, I think the economy would recover, provided that there is a change of government.
You're a South African entrepreneur. Presumably, you're fairly optimistic then about the future of the South African economy.
Yes, I am.
You're also an accomplished jazz musician. Does your music help you take your mind off what the rating agencies might or might not do about South Africa's debt rating?
Yeah, it also gives me space to actually write about South Africa. I write songs that reflect the good and the bad of South Africa. So yes, it does take my mind off of some of the nonsense going on in the country.
Ashley Ali.
Behind the headlines.
With 6 gold, 6 silvers and 1 bronze medal, Kenya finished second only to the United States in the athletics table at the Rio Olympics. These were Kenya's most successful games to date, despite the doping and the organisational challenges. The East African nation is well known for its prowess in running competitions, but athletics footwear is mostly the preserve of foreign companies like Adidas and Nike. However, 2 young entrepreneurs are creating a Kenyan shoe brand which they hope will reflect and benefit from the country's Olympic glory. Virgil Reinhardt has more.
Kenyan David Rudisha maintained his 800-metre men's title in Rio recently, becoming the first man to do so since the New Zealand's Peter Snell in 1964. The 27-year-old Kenyan is just one of many Kenyans to excel in middle to long distance at this year's Olympics. 2 entrepreneurs inspired by Kenya's athletic talent are embarking on a journey to create the country's first high-performance running shoe. Kenyan Osembo Ombati and American Weldon Kennedy met at a pitching competition in Kenya and soon realized that both of them were passionate about running.
Initially, we started it as a sport discussion. Then we were like, you know what, we're really, really great at running. We have all these medals, we have all these athletes, but there's just never been a running shoe that espouses Kenyan style of running.
The name of the shoe that the duo came up with was Enda Eaton. Enda is a Swahili word for go, a common chant of the audience in a running competition. And Eaton is a small town in the Kenyan Rift Valley where most of the champions come from. The town is also known to be a popular training ground for local and international athletes.
That's how we started it, like a joke. And slowly we started meeting and having discussions and looking for the right team. And eventually we got the right, to a point where we were able to make the shoe. So basically we made the shoe as a desire to bring the benefits of running back to the home of running champions, which is Kenya. We are definitely planning to feature in the next Olympics in 2020.
The shoe is yet to hit the market, but dedicated marathon runners have tested the prototype, an important step of marketing the young company. German-Kenyan recreation runner Valeria Cheng was one of the first testers, and she is enthusiastic about the prototype.
The shoes are very light. That means that even when I'm totally exhausted, I don't even notice that I'm running. They are very comfortable and breathe really well.
The image that the company prints on its shoe is based on the traditional hunting spear that is also celebrated on Kenya's flag. Many Kenyans have also welcomed the idea of a Kenyan shoe brand and have shown strong support, explains Osembo Ombati.
Locally, there's been a lot of support for it by people on social media and also in the news. And basically, people, Kenyans are excited about the brand because everybody's saying it's about time that we do something that really supports our country and supports our athletes.
The two entrepreneurs raised enough money from the friends and family for a prototype based on the advice, skills and experiences of great Kenyan athletes who tested it. The shoe will not only build brand Kenya, but the company hopes to bring some of the running industry's dollars back home.
Virgil Reinhardt reporting.
Listen to Africa Link whenever you want. Sign up for our podcast at dw.com/AfricaLinkPodcasts.
Tradition plays an important role in many African countries. Some practices that come with tradition have been discarded simply because they are considered outdated or a health risk. But in eastern Uganda and parts of western Kenya, circumcising teenage boys using blunt knives as an initiation into adulthood is still a common practice carried out at regular intervals. In Uganda, the ritual is supported by President Yoweri Museveni, and efforts are underway to promote it as a tourist attraction. Alex Jitter reports.
It is circumcision season, or embalu, as it is locally known. The practice is done every 2 years. It implies the circumcision of teenage boys to mark their crossing over into manhood. The candidates are always between 10 and 18 years of age. They must prove that they are strong as men by not showing the pain they feel. However, the rudimental way in which the circumcision is carried out turns it into a risk for the young man's health. Sometimes the same knife is used on more than one candidate. Still, the practice is taken seriously, and uncircumcised men are seen as a disgrace to their families. Some are hunted and circumcised by force. There is a belief in this part of Uganda that children fathered by an uncircumcised man face difficulties in life. Damascus Situma Muyanda, a cultural leader within the Bamasaba tribe, explains.
If you had children and you are yourself not circumcised, then they get circumcised. That ritual actually has a backfire. What I mean is, Your children, they may not grow well. They may grow undisciplined, and some may die prematurely.
Every 2 years, hundreds of young Bamasaba are circumcised in ceremonies led by celebrations across the villages. To this day, Bamasaba living in urban areas and even the capital, Kampala, carry out these rituals. 16-year-old Martin Situka from Bagisu tribe was among the first to be circumcised.
I grew up when I know that a Riamugisu should be circumcised. So I'm sure that I will be circumcised and I will finish this ceremony very well.
After the circumcision, the youth is now pronounced a man. Although there are other ceremonies that follow to complete the crossover into manhood. Gisu women are even encouraged to report their uncircumcised husbands to the elders. Many traditional rituals have been discouraged, but Embalu is not one of them. Now the authorities are trying to enlist the help of traditional leaders to make the practice safer. And the Uganda and Kenya tourism boards have even sensed an opportunity to turn the tradition into cash. They have agreed to jointly promote the Embalu circumcision in eastern Uganda and western Kenya as a potential tourism attraction. John Sempebwa is the executive director of the Uganda Tourism Board.
Uganda expects at least 2,000 Kenyans. Each of them is coming with money because they need hotels, they need food, they need entertainment, they need drink, they need to travel.
President Yoweri Museveni himself has encouraged this ritual. He said it fits in well with today's modern society, where all men are encouraged to get circumcised for health purposes. The tourism experts intend to market the Embalu festivals across the world using the Ugandan embassies. They hope that the strategy will be as successful as the marketing of the Mountain Gorillas guided tours, which now fetch Uganda an incredible $17.4 million a year.
Alex Jetta reporting.
Opinion.
And for opinion today, we return to our top story. We've been hearing US Secretary of State John Kerry praising the Nigerian government for recovering huge areas that have been taken by the Boko Haram militants, but at the same time warning Nigeria to respect human rights when fighting extremists. Do you think the Nigerian government will heed his advice? We also heard a former ANC freedom fighter telling us who he believes is responsible for the ANC's declining fortunes.
I think Jacob Zuma has a lot of blame to carry for the decline of the party. But the rot has spread so far and deep that you cannot blame Zuma alone anymore. The ANC is to blame.
What do you think? Should the sole blame for South Africa's problems be assigned to President Jacob Zuma or not? Send us your thoughts on these stories either in an SMS to country code 49 160 957 595 10, an email to feedback.africa@dw.com, or a letter to Africa Link DW 53110 Bonn, Germany. More news from Africa before we leave you. Riek Machar, South Sudan's former rebel leader and vice president who fled the country last week, has re-emerged in neighbouring Sudan. Khartoum announced on Tuesday that Machar had needed urgent medical attention. His whereabouts had been largely unknown for weeks, leaving an already fragile peace deal in South Sudan in limbo. A spokesman for Sudan's government said Machar's condition was now stable. Our main story this Wednesday morning: US Secretary of State John Kerry has praised Nigeria for its recent gains against Boko Haram Islamists, but did not confirm Nigerian military claims that the group's leader Abubakar Shekau had been wounded. Kerry also cautioned against a heavy-handed response and emphasised the need to respect human rights. And there we come to the end of this edition of Africa Link. Do join us again tomorrow if you can. For more news, do visit our website dw.com/Africa. Thank you for listening. This is Mark Caldwell in Bonn.